It's gone. Cool. So many recordings. I've got OBS having like two tracks plus my Tascam off on the side.
Okay,
just
good.
In case.
And I have IBS, so we're covered.
Everybody, and welcome back to the 305. Today we are watching film number 9, The Magnificent Ambersons by Orson Welles. And today my guest is once again eminent Orson Welles scholar and fanboy, Aaron Seckington.
Okay, eminent Orson, you're always doing this to me. Hello, everybody. Welcome to our new podcast, All's Wells That Ends Wells.
That's that's the sub-podcast within the podcast.
Yeah, might as well be.
So, Magnificent Ambersons, I know you've heard of this movie. Have you seen it?
No, I'm really excited about this.
Yeah, what are your impressions so far?
Welles was not happy with the final product. I know that. And then there's some debate on whether or not the studio deliberately destroyed the master of it. Oof. So that he couldn't release a director's cut.
Mm-hmm. Well, they didn't even do director's cuts back then.
He probably would have invented one. I'm not necessarily being facetious. I could see a world where he bought the rights so that he could re-release it again.
Yeah. Well, and just to clarify here, from the back of the Laserdisc, this film is 88 minutes shortened from 131 minutes.
That's a big...
yeah, they cut almost
50-minute
half the film.
Cut, yeah.
Yeah. Largely in the last act, I believe.
Gosh.
And as you said, Orson Welles was not happy about that. A lot of people think that this film didn't really suffer that much for it. I've seen this before. I actually liked it quite a bit. So I'm curious, it's been a few years, so I'm curious to see how well it holds up for my current film brain. But yeah, any last thoughts before we dive right into this?
No, I've been reading, this is Orson Welles again, of course, the Book of Interviews with Peter Bogdanovich, and I'm interested to see how the film matches up with what he complains about in that work.
Dude, I hope you have a list of complaints to read off after we watch this.
Here's a list of ailments with the film.
Yeah, exactly. Bob Duca style.
As Bob Duca, yes.
All right. Well, thank you for that. We will go ahead and watch this film.
As always, go get your laser disc and watch it real quick.
Watch it with us. We're going to take actually a couple days break after watching this just to let it sink in and do some further investigating of all these wonderful special features, and then we will, through the magic of podcasting, be right back.
Slutar du aldrig att fråga?
Nej. Jag slutar aldrig.
Join us soon for a conversation on an icon of arthouse cinema and the Criterion Collection's first foreign language picture, Swedish director Ingmar Bergman's The Seventh Seal. Welcome back, everybody. We are here after having finally gotten to see The Magnificent Ambersons after a bumpy start.
Yeah,
Aaron, how did you end up finally watching it?
That was a story. I wound up renting it on YouTube.
Okay. Did it look good, at least? Sound good?
Yeah, it looked and sounded fine.
Yeah. The trouble we had is that it turns out, I don't know if this is on like every version of Criterion's releases, But on mine, at least, the normal audio track, the volume was just completely all over the place. There is some kind of glitch that causes it to be almost unwatchable because you can't keep the volume consistent.
Yeah, and certainly on my end, I really couldn't deal with it because I was getting it through a stream. John and I share a stream of it. So on your end, you said almost unwatchable. On my end, fully unwatchable.
So for all two of you ever who listen to this and also watch this on the Laserdisc, if you haven't figured it out...
Well, those two people are here talking right now.
Well, to my future self who forgets, just turn off the CX audio and listen to the audio without the noise reduction. That turned out completely fine. I don't know what happened. But we did get there, so we watched it separately. We've had some time to think about it, and now we're back. So what I kind of wanted to open this up with was just the question of, why do you think Welles wanted to make this story in particular after having just got all this acclaim for Citizen Kane?
That's a good question. I would say... For Welles, probably it's, you know, it touches on, like, questions of mortality and getting old. And he was still pretty young when he made this.
Right. So, he was only 30-something?
Yeah.
No, not even 30.
I don't know. I should have looked that up. He was still
quite
young.
He was, like, 26 or 27, yeah.
And I think he was sort of, like, taken... by the book's preoccupation with aging and changing.
Mm-hmm.
And that's probably what attracted him to this story, because dude loves old age makeup. You can see that in Kane, and you can see that in this, and he's almost always playing characters who are older than him when he's a young man. Like, he made Chimes at Midnight not long after this, and Falstaff is heavily made up.
Mm. I haven't seen that one yet. So he's playing a really old character?
He's playing a character at the end of his life.
Oh, okay. Well, I did... so this book that the movie was based on came out in 1918, which is only 3 years after Welles was born. So by the time that he read this, it was already kind of an old story. And I did the math, and... it was shot in 1941, but set in the 1900s. So this is like if somebody today had just had this, like, blockbuster movie, this epic drama that took place over all time, decades. And then for his next movie, he was like, you know what I really want to do? A 1980s family drama about the coming age of computers and how that's going to transform society, possibly for the worse.
I would watch that.
I would too, but it is an interesting about face, having just come off of Citizen Kane.
Yeah, but
I think in some ways.
Like, I see the thematic lines connecting these things.
Mm-hmm.
You know, talking about change. And I don't think I'm too clever for noticing that, because that's literally the opening montage of the film.
Right.
Kind of hammers you over the head with the themes that we're going to talk about by showing the way fashion
changed.
In Welles'
own voice.
Yeah, by showing the way fashion changed very quickly. Mm-hmm. And people talk about the automobile, I think. How do they pronounce it weird?
Yeah.
Or they say
do.
It weird.
Well, and they also say, like, horseless carriage and stuff like that.
Yeah, horseless carriage doesn't sound as weird as the way they say, like, automobile or whatever they call
oh,
it.
Oh, yeah, I think that might have been it.
It's all, yeah. Automobile. They always have this weird inflection with it.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, so it establishes pretty quickly that the thesis is that things are always changing. Technology, fashion... the times are changing, but the movie is kind of about how people don't really.
Okay. Go on. result?
I don't know. I think going on further would be just the plot. You know, George is a real piece of shit his whole life.
Absolutely. Yeah, a regular Monty Burns, as you pointed out.
Yeah, we'll get to that. Joe Cotton's character he's always in love with this woman, and you know, he's got Aunt Fanny pining over him. Like people don't really change.
That's true. Every character kind of has that core thing about them their whole life.
And it's sort of I know senility is touched on in this movie with the major,
the grandpa.
Yeah. But it sort of implies that the only time he undergoes any kind of real change is at the very end of his life.
And it's just like random and sad.
Yeah. And it's kind of, I almost kind of don't like it because it sort of implies that this is what's causing his condition. I'm sure that's not the intended subtext there, but that is something I got from it, is that it implies that his preoccupation with realizing that he's never changed is what's causing his senility.
Interesting. I can kind of see that. But one thing that I noticed. Well, I was gonna. I also made a note of myself just because I thought it was really intriguing to me. Is that in the dynamic between George, the younger man, and then Eugene, who's the older competitor for his mother's affections? That it's George, the younger man, who wants to stay essentially stuck in the past. Like, he hates the idea of the automobile. He's all about horseless carriages, and
horseful carriages.
But yeah, he wants to hold on to this idea of his family as being this great, gentry, essentially, and they've got all this money and power that'll never go away. And it's the older guy who is inventing the future. He's a successful inventor of a new form of transportation. And he even has some great lines about the future. Like, the one quote that I wrote down just because I liked it the most out of the movie was near the beginning. It's at the party. Eugene is having just a random conversation while dancing, and somebody mentioned something about time, like the old times. And his response is,
I wrote this one down too. Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, good. There aren't any old times. When times are gone, they're not old, they're dead. There aren't any times but new times. Which I thought, for him, summed up a lot of things. Even though, as you pointed out, conversely, like, he always pined for this old romantic love from his youthful days. But anyway, I guess the movie that this made me think of the most, and I'm not totally sure why, but Barry Lyndon came to mind. Have you seen that one?
Yeah, I'm a big Barry Lyndon stan.
And I guess, you know, part of it is that it's a period drama about rich people, and the main character is very similarly, like, hot-headed and just kind of a crappy person for most of the movie. Also trying to fight for his family's honor in different ways.
That's an interesting comparison, partially because I don't quite see it. It's got those little bits, like you say, but George is born into this aristocracy in a way that literally no one else in his family was.
Because it's the grandpa that made the fortune, right?
Yeah, but even then, that was during his parents' lifetime. So, and he made it just through investments, which is interesting because like that's passive, right? Compared to inventing,
right.
Which is an active pursuit.
Mm-hmm.
So he keeps using the word riffraff throughout the movie to refer to everyone else, which is interesting because no one else in his family talks that way. But
mm-hmm. because and queer-looking duck.
Yeah, he was born into this fortune and this position in the community, and that's sort of what ruined him because he refuses to get a job. He won't go to school. He won't do anything.
He said he wants to be a yachtsman when he grows up, I think.
Sure, you know, whatever. And the most unrealistic part of this movie is that a family that wealthy could lose money ever. I guess that was still a thing that you could happen during the turn of the century, but nowadays the wealthy just kind of stay wealthy forever.
Sure seems like it.
Okay,
so I'll give it to you that the comparisons to Barry Lyndon stop early. I guess it just felt, maybe it's been a while since I've watched it, but something about the tone of the movie that just came to mind.
Don't take that as an attack, sorry. It's
Oh, no, not an attack. I've noticed that I have a tendency to make very loose connections between things on this podcast. So I'm trying to work on strengthening them. In any case, the last thing that I wanted to say about the story for me was just a funny little thing that apparently... the wiki mentioned that there is a newspaper at one point in the movie that they show a close-up of, and if you look closely at it, it's from Kane's newspaper, and
Whoa.
One of the articles is written by Joe Cotton's character, and there's even a little photo of him on the paper. So in
All right.
a way,
the Wellsverse,
the Ambersons is part, exactly, the Wells cinematic universe. You ripped the joke right from my mouth.
Oh, man. So, hold on. That means Unicron is real, right? That has to be the...
Oh, right. The Transformers character that Wells played?
Yeah.
Yeah, presumably that's in the same timeline as the Ambersons, just
I
much further in the future.
Yeah, in the future. They don't know that, but Unicron is coming.
I think that's what makes this movie so dark, actually, is just that overtone, knowing that Unicron will be showing up eventually. There's a lot of foreshadowing. It was a very long game for Wells.
All right. Plot synopsis? Is that a thing we do? We talked, generally.
Yeah. Well, I'd like to let you do that.
Oh, crap. I was super not prepared to do this.
All right. Well...
I could summarize the Wikipedia.
I mean, that's basically what I'm doing. But off the top of my head, we've got the story of the Ambersons / the Minifers, which are the sort of head of the family is Major, the grandpa. He's on the Amberson side. His daughter, Isabel... has a courtship with Eugene Morgan when she's a young woman, and Eugene ends up making a complete ass of himself. I can't remember the details of what happened, but it ended up with him falling into a cello.
He's trying to serenade her, and he's drunk, and he falls over a cello, and I guess engagement off.
Yeah.
At that point.
And so she ends up instead marrying, I believe his name is Wilbur Minifer. So she becomes an Amberson Minifer.
Yeah, who doesn't really feature into the story.
Not really. And then her sister, I think her older sister Fanny, comes to live with them in this great mansion that's owned by the grandfather, if I'm not mistaken. And Isabel and Wilbur... have a son, George, who we meet at the near the beginning of the story. He's, as you said, he's born into wealth. He's had a silver spoon in his mouth the whole time. He's a total jerk and a bully as a kid. And there's a lot of talk at the beginning about how the townspeople all wish they could live to see the day that that kid gets his comeuppance. They really want him to get his, because we see all these scenes of him being just a total brat. And then he finally grows up, and we cut into the present day of the story where George is coming home from college, and they throw a big party in his honor at the mansion. And that is where Eugene Morgan has also come back after many years away, and he has a lovely young daughter. Oh, I'm forgetting her name.
Lucy.
There you go. Who shows up to the party. Lucy meets George. George falls for her instantly. He starts trying to woo her and not doing a terrific job of it, I would say. And he doesn't know this whole time that her dad is Eugene, who all those years ago tried to court his own mother.
Yeah, this is weird because it's sort of framed like a comedy scene.
Sure, yeah.
But there's sort of nothing funny.
But it doesn't really play out that way.
There's nothing funny in it.
Basically. It's hard. Did Wells do any comedies? They were all dramas, right?
I should know the answer to this. But, I mean, like, Citizen Kane has a sense of humor in it. Citizen Kane is really funny throughout.
Yeah, he definitely... I know from reading that he did try to make this intentionally darker.
Yeah.
Just because he felt this was the story was a tragedy. So we have that party scene and everybody parts ways. And then the rest of the movie has this sort of competing storylines about courtship where George is trying to win over Lucy, but at the same time, Eugene is trying to win back the affections of Isabel, the mom. And about halfway through, the dad, Wilbur, dies suddenly. So that opens the door even further for Eugene to swoop in. And then we have this competition where George is simultaneously trying to win over Lucy and prevent Eugene from getting close to his mother.
Mm-hmm.
He really wants this full control of everybody. And it becomes this, I guess, allegory in a way of these two forces of the past and the present, or the future rather, fighting and trying to gain control over the other.
Well, it's sort of, I would say it's more progress and stasis.
There we go. Yeah, that's a better way of putting it.
Eugene's whole philosophy is, like you said, there aren't any times but new times, and he's always trying to move forward into the future, and George mm-hmm. wants things to be exactly the way they are, except also with Lucy.
Yeah. So I hope I'm not missing a part in here, but I know that eventually George, he learns the story of the original courtship between Eugene and his mom. He didn't know this yet. And it just sends him into a rage. He also discovers that Fanny has had the hots for Eugene this whole time. And he's told by Fanny that essentially the whole town knows this except him. And there have been all these rumors about Eugene coming back to sweep Isabel off her feet again. This makes him just insane with jealousy. He accosts a local neighbor about these rumors just out of the blue, and finally decides that the way he's going to get away from all of this is to take his mother on a global trip of some kind, so that the two of them can be together and alone. And he tries to use this as like a gambit to win Lucy over one final time. But it backfires because she's totally, not taken in by the idea of him leaving. She's like, oh, that sounds great. I hope you have a wonderful time there. So, defeated, he leaves. Isabel ends up falling sick during the trip. George doesn't want to come home even though she's sick, but finally relents. They get home. Isabel is on her deathbed at this point. She must have caught some terrible disease overseas. And George prevents Eugene from seeing his mother even then, and she finally passes away. This brings us right about to the end of the story in the edited version of the movie. George is finally, you know, he's lost his mother, he's lost everything, his grandpa has gone senile and also passed away. Turns out his estate is actually worthless, and they're going to have to get rid of the house, and everybody will move out to try and fend for themselves. George moves in with his Aunt Fanny into a boarding house that he's trying to pay for by taking up a terrible job working in like a dynamite factory. And then finally, in some poetic justice, he ends up in an automobile accident and loses the use of both of his legs. That brings us to the final scene, which is Eugene and Fanny at the hospital outside of the bedroom. We don't actually see George anymore. And they walk away as Eugene relates.
This is resolved in a pickup shot.
Essentially, it really is. Eugene relates how he's just talked to George and feels really good because George finally reached out and said, like, I'm sorry. And Eugene felt the spirit of Isabel watching over them and being happy that Eugene would finally be able to take care of the family in some way. And that is this very abrupt end of the movie.
Yeah.
And then the reason for that, I guess we'll get into a little bit when we talk about the behind-the-scenes stuff, but you're right, it really was a pickup shot that they did not have before. It was changed from the way that Orson originally intended was a much, I think, darker in tone, if not substance, but there was a lot of back and forth in the editing process that caused this.
Yeah. Apparently, and I haven't read the book, so I cannot guarantee this myself, but apparently this is fairly close to the book ending, more so than Orson's original.
Oh, right, because the book had a kind of a happy ending, apparently.
Yeah.
Or is the idea that, like, everybody makes up in the end.
Yeah.
Whereas, I guess I'll say that on the Laserdisc, there's actually a lot of special features on here, which are really cool. There's the usual commentary, but then there's a couple of clips of Wells talking about the movie, and it actually has the entire shooting script from Wells of the original uncut version. Now, I didn't sit down and like read through the entire thing on the Laserdisc, but I did read through the final scene that Wells was so apparently angry about that they had changed. And it's interesting to me that the dialogue is actually very close in terms of, like, it's a scene of Eugene talking to Fanny about having visited George in the hospital and so on. But the way that it plays out is different, because in the movie, it's them exiting the hospital. Fanny seems happy. Everybody's like, great, things will be taken care of from now on. Whereas in Wells' version that he shot, Eugene was actually visiting Fanny in the boarding house and discovering her living in this like really cramped environment where like everybody's sharing the common areas and she's just sort of prattling on to this group of old women. They step aside for a moment and just sit in some rocking chairs talking about having gone to the hospital, and it seems clear that Fanny has just sort of given up on life, as it were, and is very just sort of barely paying attention to Eugene as he talks about this, and it's making Eugene very nostalgic and disappointed about how things turned out. So it really doesn't seem like he's going to come in and save the day anymore.
Mm.
And then the disc actually also has all of the storyboards from the uncut version, so you can actually see at least the drawings of how every shot was going to play out originally. And then the...
Does it have the hallway fight where George fights three guys with a machete? In the original?
It does. It's very...
That's interesting.
It's got sort of comic, like, Marvel energy there.
I got kind of bored to the end, so I paused it for a second and watched some clips of the Raid.
What is the Raid?
Oh, it's a super, super good movie.
Okay. Should I check it out?
You should absolutely check it out.
Should our listeners check it out?
Everyone should check it out. It's an incredibly violent, grounded, gritty martial arts film.
Just as well as originally intended, yes.
Yeah, so I had to... it was like 2 in the morning when I was finishing this, so I had to pause it. I had to watch some of the Raid to get my energy up. Because I would say... I don't think I'm being unfair if I say this film starts to drag in the second act, which is most of it.
Oh, it really does. Yeah.
This film is 90% second act.
Well... And second act is essentially where it ends because, you know, if you add in 50 minutes of film, that's an entire third act that didn't get into there.
Right.
Yeah. So I was going to talk about the actors for a little bit, our ensemble here, just some things that I found out about them. First, we had, so there's George, Amberson Minifer. He is played by Joseph Gordon-Levitt, correct, as I believe you'll recognize.
Joseph Gordon-Levitt, who went on to do a bunch of cowboy films after this.
Exactly.
Time out. I want to see Joseph Gordon-Levitt do a Western, actually. Now I've okay. breathed life into this golem.
Yeah, I'm surprised he hasn't yet. He's had such a varied career. But yes, I could see that. Maybe he'll remake one of Tim Holtz movies. We can have him, Gordon Levitt, in The Treasure of the Sierra Madre.
Oh, shit, I'd watch that.
So Tim Holtz, he, as you mentioned, he was in a ton of Westerns, a lot of low-budget stuff. Before he was at RKO, he actually had a long-running contract with the producer Walter Wenger, who... coincidentally produced Invasion of the Body Snatchers, which was our last episode.
Oh, there we go.
Yeah. Criterion somehow manages to tie these things together, or it's just happenstance because Hollywood is so incestuous. In any case, Tim Holt showed up in Stagecoach in 1939, which is just a couple years before this. And then when he went to RKO, it was all almost entirely low-budget Westerns. So it was kind of a fluke that he ended up in Amberson's. Wells just, he was looking around at who RKO had at the time and noticed him and thought he was interesting. I think it worked out really well.
I sort of wonder if that character in Hail Caesar is based on him a little bit.
Oh, yeah. I really didn't like that movie, but now that you say that, I could imagine that.
I finally watched it this year, and I did like it. It's sort of, you know, it's a middle of the road Coen Brothers.
I guess that's kind of it for me, is that it was just so middle of the road. I wasn't really, I don't know. I just never got invested in it.
Yeah, it's fine, but it was a fair way to pass the time. But yeah, I'm curious if the time period's not exactly correct, but I'm sort of curious if Hobie Doyle is a little bit based on Tim Holt.
Yeah. Knowing the Coen brothers, I guess, and their output, it wouldn't surprise me if they were to do a deep cut reference like that.
Like, I'm sure that the more obvious thing would be like Roy Rogers, but...
Sure.
Anyway.
Well, and it could even be a pastiche of all of them.
I don't want to get too far ahead, but I think we keep talking about other movies for a reason.
Yes, keep that in mind for later.
I'm starting to intuit that we had a very similar experience, except you didn't watch machete fights.
Well, to your knowledge. So Tim Holt, he did. He actually became a B-29 bombardier in World War II. Like right after Magnificent Ambersons. I think he was in one last movie called Hitler's Children, and then he went off to World War II.
Oh, he was in Boys from Brazil?
He was?
What? No, that was a joke.
Oh, okay.
Spoilers for Boys from Brazil.
Yeah, I knew that had something to do with Nazis, but I didn't make the connection. So he was in World War II. He flew in the Pacific Theater, ended up, it said, wounded over Tokyo on the last day of the war, and awarded the Purple Heart and the Distinguished Flying Cross. Then he comes back from the war, continues doing Westerns, and then ends up in The Treasure of the Sierra Madre, which was his other, like, most famous film, I would say. Then we've got Agnes Moorehead as Fanny. She was a veteran actress, much... I think about 15 years older than Orson Welles, but she's
super good in this.
Yeah, and she got actually for it a Golden Globe for Best Supporting Actress and a nomination from the Academy Awards.
Mm-hmm.
She was actually part of the Mercury Players, which was Orson's like theater and radio company.
Yeah, she was in Kane, right?
Yeah, she was Kane's mother.
Okay.
And then, you know, they just had this long, good working relationship, and so he put her in Ambersons as Fanny, where she just was all over the place, like, very dramatic role for her. There is a weird... I noticed something, and I'd be curious to find out the answer, but... Like, the last scene that you see of her with George in, I want to say, in the boarding house.
Mm-hmm.
Or no, it's in the mansion, maybe? Where they turned off the heat?
Yep.
Yeah, it's this, it's kind of the darkest moment for Fanny, because she's just lost a grip after her family has started passing away and everything's going to hell. And there's a story from Agnes where she talks about that scene being directed by Orson Welles. And
I like this story because I think it's probably true. And yeah. I'm guessing that because someone who wasn't Orson Welles told it.
Well, that's a good point. Would you like to tell it?
Yeah, just that every single take he would give her a wildly different thing to play. Like, play it like you're a little girl. Okay, now play it like you're drunk. Now... Play it like nothing, you know, you're just numb, you know, no emotion or whatever. And then mm-hmm. finally on the 12th take, when she was exhausted, he said, "Now play it." And she managed to combine all 12 of those emotions into a really memorable scene. Because mm-hmm. that's what he wanted from her, was like to get all of these little bits and pieces of stuff, because people are complicated. People don't play things on one note.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was the way to add some veracity to her performance.
Yeah.
Huge if true.
Good way to put it. Well, the reason I say that I'm confused about it is that, if I'm not mistaken, in the notes on the disc about everything that happened afterwards with this, after shooting was over, part of the re-editing was that the studio reshot several scenes, including like they made this new hospital scene at the end. But it mentions exactly who shot these different scenes, like the second unit director, and they give his name, the second cinematographer, all that stuff. And they say that the boiler scene actually was one of the reshot scenes. Which makes it very odd as to how the story about Orson Welles came out if he was in South America at the time.
Huh.
Yeah, so I don't know if either the disc was mistaken or I read it wrong, or maybe
Well, apparently
they did shoot it, but then they reshot it, and she was telling the story of the original.
Yeah, shot. It's hard to tell. And apparently the interview she told that story was in the 70s, so she may just be mistaken also. That was 30 years later.
That's true. It's possible. And actually, I guess just because you mentioned that, in the 70s, one of the tidbits I saw was that Orson Welles had this grand idea to reshoot the ending to the movie with the cast then, and set the whole thing like 20 years later and re-release the movie. Apparently, for whatever reason, this didn't happen. Maybe it was just, you know, this dream that Orson has, and he didn't really... I don't know, he just didn't put in the effort on it. I'm not sure. Did you read anything about that?
No, I didn't want to focus too much on that because that didn't wind up happening. I read that it happened, and or the attempt the attempt was made, but I don't know how far he got in that.
Right. It's an interesting... I mean, apparently that just came out in an interview with Bogdanovich, I guess. So just one of those...
Yeah, asides. So again, is it true? I have no idea.
It's All True, as his next movie was called. Let's see. After Agnes, we've got Dolores Costello as Isabel. She was a silent screen actress, long career. She was a child actor. Her parents were both actors in vaudeville. And she ended up married to John Barrymore and is the grandmother of Drew Barrymore.
Mm-hmm.
Which is a neat little
factoid.
Apparently, this is a weird quote that I read about her. Her film career was largely ruined by the destructive effects of early film makeup, which ravaged her complexion too severely to camouflage.
I'm looking at pictures of her. That don't seem to be the case.
Yeah, I mean, that was referenced in a book or two, I guess, but... I had never heard of early film makeup causing that on anybody. In any case, she did retire only a year after Amberson's. I think she had like one more movie and that was it for her.
Yeah, you'd have to get someone with more makeup expertise than me. I'm sure you know someone who could comment on that, but
probably I'll find someone for one of the special effects movies who could talk about the makeup.
Well, you know, there's that thing like in The Wizard of Oz, the original Tin Man was super allergic to whatever paint they were using.
That paint.
Because it had, like, actual metal in it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. Maybe all metallic paint does. But, you know, back then they were just going, here you go. We've made this paste out of lead and mercury. And
could just dab this on your tongue.
It looks really good under these carbon arc lights that we're using to light this picture and absolutely destroy everyone's eyes. So
don't forget to wear your radium watch.
So I don't know if that happened, but absolutely I could see that happening.
Yeah, it has perhaps an element of truth. We've got... Well, I guess I'll just say Joseph Cotten as Eugene Morgan. I don't want to leave him out, but I didn't take as many notes on him just because we talked about him so much in Citizen Kane.
And Third Man, where he's the star.
Oh, yeah, of course, and Third Man. He is here again. He delivers an excellent performance, as usual.
And as usual, I would say, like, maybe just go watch The Third Man if you want to see Joseph Cotten.
Yep. I will agree with that statement.
I'm gonna out myself and say definitively, okay. I didn't care for this movie too much. I've been dancing around it, but I just want to say like I didn't really care for it.
I remember liking it more the last time I watched it, and this time around, it just didn't seem to hold up for me. I don't know. Would you ever? Maybe it's too early to tell. Do you think you would ever watch it again?
No. Not unless I had to. I don't know that this is a movie that gets better with repeated viewing.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of a family melodrama, and I know most dramas that we see in movies are essentially family melodramas, but It's got a very unsympathetic lead.
Mm-hmm.
It does not have the sort of technical stuff that made Kane stand out for me. Like, I couldn't point to...
Yeah, not as much.
I couldn't point to a shot where I go, oh, okay, there we go. They worked hard on this.
Mm-hmm.
The same way I could with Kane, which, if you recall, I also kind of didn't like.
Right. Yeah, on that repeat viewing, I remember. Well, I think you said at the time that it's like, it's hard to tell maybe if it's because so many other things have come out since then that have been influenced by these movies that it's hard to really appreciate what's here.
Yeah, I also think, just personally, it's the genre of rich people feeling bad is tough for me to feel sympathetic about. And I know that is in the classical mold of a tragedy where you've got someone in a high status position
mm-hmm.
who falls somehow, either financially or morally or whatever. So I understand it. I understand the tradition it's part of, but now that we're living in a society that is rapidly approaching another age of guillotines, it's harder to really feel for these characters, to connect with them.
You know, it's funny that you say that, because one of the things I read from Wells, and I couldn't find it again when I went to go look it up, but he was talking about what the studio had done to his film, and his like almost his exact words were, once you take out the stuff that I shot, it's just a movie about rich people bickering with each other. So he honestly felt the same way that you did about his own film after they'd taken it to the cutting room.
Yeah, but that's also the plot. So I don't understand what what the studio could have...
How those 50 minutes were going to really save it.
Quote-unquote removed that
yeah.
change the framework that the movie is hung on.
Yeah. Maybe someday I'll read through the shooting script and tell you if I find anything shocking in there. Like the machete fight scene.
Well, and they play Monopoly in real time for... almost 90 more minutes.
I'll wrap up the
mother,
the action
father. I've just found the most wonderful board game.
When was Monopoly invented? Could they have done that?
When
it was the landlord's game?
Yeah, I think almost that could have almost happened.
Yeah, let's see. Oh, it could have, yeah, because the landlord's game was invented in 1904, or patented in 1904. So it's conceivable that they could have played it together.
Okay, awesome. That would be...
Which is, of course, the precursor to Monopoly, the landlord's game.
Yeah, I was going to say, this could almost... People talk often that the Monopoly movie rights have been horse-traded around for...
Oh, geez.
Like a decade between studios. You're aware of that, I'm sure.
Yeah.
This could basically be it.
Not surprised. Yeah, there's our tagline. It's just the Magnificent Ambersons, Monopoly the movie. A Hasbro film.
Or Monopoly : Ambersons edition.
I'll Photoshop that up and add it to the post.
with the major as Uncle Pennybags.
There we go. It really sells itself, honestly. So, well, speaking of the major, that was Ray Collins. He was another Mercury Theater actor with Wells and Joe Cotton and Agnes Moorehead. He was also in Kane. He was Kane's political rival near the end.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Yeah. This guy appeared in more than 75 films over his career.
Oh, sorry, that was Jack. Richard Bennett is the major. Jack is the congressman.
Oh, you're right. I'm sorry. Uncle Jack. I even forgot that in the plot. Yeah, it's there's Fanny is the sister, and then Jack is the brother.
Yeah, that character also disappears for a while.
Yeah.
And then he comes back to deliver a monologue, and then he gets on a train and leaves the picture.
Yeah, that about sums it up. Thank you for filling that back in. And then finally we've got Anne Baxter as Lucy Morgan. She was apparently the granddaughter of Frank Lloyd Wright.
Oh.
She was a teen actress on Broadway. She then, her first film experience was screen testing for Hitchcock's Rebecca, which is actually coming up in a few, I think it's like in the teens in the Criterion Collection. She later won an Academy Award for supporting actress in The Razor's Edge, which I have not seen, but sounds interesting, and starred in the movie All About Eve, which I know is another famous movie.
That movie's great.
Oh, you've seen it? Cool. Yeah, well, that's her. So that was Lucy.
Yeah, Cammy connected with a very old friend once, and we asked him his favorite movie, and he said All About Eve, so we had to go watch it. And turns out it's great.
Awesome. Yeah, unfortunately, it's not in the original collection, but I know it's since, I believe, come out on DVD and Blu-ray by Criterion. Well, that wraps it up for the actors. Did you have anything else?
No, I already said Agnes Moorehead is super good.
And that's really the main point that we're trying to get across here. So then, technical stuff. Let's talk about what there is, at least. I know you said you didn't really come away impressed by any of it.
I mean, it's serviceable. Nothing's bad in it. I think the costumes are great. Claire Kramer and whoever else worked on it did a really good job. I read but could not substantiate that the costumes in this film were used in a good deal of other movies, but that in itself is not that unusual.
Sure. Well, I think from what I read about the movie as a whole, or the design of it, they were extremely meticulous in their research for the movie. So it doesn't surprise me that they would end up reusing those costumes. Probably, one, because they were super expensive, and they wouldn't want to put those to waste, but then also just because they would have put in a lot of effort making them very realistic for the time period, which was, 40 years, set 40 years before the movie actually came out. Mm-hmm. So I'm sure they had plenty of use for them. The mansion itself, the Amberson Mansion, apparently this is a three-story mansion that they built basically in its entirety as sets. At some point they used the whole place in a shot in the movie. Like they've got the ballroom, the kitchen, the bathroom at one point, the giant spiral staircase in the middle of the hall, bedrooms up on the top floor, and they built this whole thing as multiple sets, essentially like one set per floor, with the staircases sort of faked throughout.
Yeah.
And I thought that, for me, I did notice a few shots that were pretty cool, and it was usually where they're moving the camera a lot more during the action than they were in Kane. This is, of course, a new cinematographer. Kane was Greg Toland, who was, like, already a veteran. Whereas this movie was a guy named Stanley Cortez. He was actually also mostly known for low-budget westerns. But apparently Wells just saw some, like, a portfolio of sorts and thought, wow, this guy's actually, he's really fast and he's got his own personal style. And that's what I need for this movie.
Well, he also did Night of the Hunter, which is considered one of the best.
That's a fantastic movie.
Noir movies, yeah.
Yeah, and excellent cinematography in that, too. There's I just saw, again, a shot from that movie of, spoilers, but there's a woman who dies at the bottom of a lake after being thrown in a car.
It's a haunting shot.
Yeah, and her hair sort of flowing up with the kelp at the bottom, basically.
Yeah.
Great stuff. I didn't know that. Thank you for pointing that out. But so he, the ones that I noticed, one of them was there was a shot outside where George and Lucy were riding in a carriage, and a horsed carriage. And he's trying to talk to her about marriage. He's like, look, we've been seeing each other for so long. Why won't you marry me? And what was cool is that the camera, they didn't just lock it to the side of the carriage. They actually had, like, somehow a crane attached to the carriage so that the camera could swing from one end of the horses to the other as they were moving down the street. It's like a minute-long shot where they do this. And I saw, I know it was a crane because the disc actually had, like, a behind-the-scenes photo where you could see Cortez and Orson sitting on the crane. That had like a slider on it of some kind so that they could pull this off. I thought that was really impressive. There's another, you mentioned earlier you wanted to talk about the staircase. One of the things I noticed was this, again, a very long shot of George following Fanny up the staircase as she's telling him about the rumors.
Most of the cool shots to me center around the staircase, and I'm sure one, that's because it's just a very affecting sort of monolith that's in the back. Like,
yeah, especially it, being rounded like that, pretty seems unusual.
It feels like it's supposed to have some symbolism, but it never quite lands a lot like a lot like the rest of the picture.
Oh boy, that does sum it up.
But I'm sure one of the other reasons is it, with that set and the verticality and stuff. And being able to like wild out the walls around it, they probably just had more technical capability centered on the staircase in general. And that may have informed some of the shots they were able to make.
Mm-hmm. Well, like, so this shot was, as he's following her up, they must have had like a lift of some kind in the middle on the ground floor with the camera on it.
Yeah, that's what I'm talking about.
Yeah, it rotated with them as they went up the staircase, and every so often the actors would stop like exactly in front of these stained glass windows as they were talking. And they did this like two or three times up until they got to the very top of the staircase. And again, this is like a, I think at least a minute long shot, pretty long take, which I thought was neat. And then finally, at the end, that reshot scene in the hospital, even though it's a pickup shot done by like a second unit director, a different cinematographer, I actually thought it was pretty neat that they did a reverse walk and talk down a hallway, just like we're used to now with like West Wing style shooting. But like the camera starts at one end of the hallway and follows both actors in a two-shot in reverse as they're discussing. And it's like, it gently moves from one actor to the other as it goes until finally they cross by the camera.
Oh, were dolly shots like that not common?
I don't want to say for certain, but it struck me as unusual for what I've seen from the time period.
Okay, yeah. That makes sense. Well, and that's kind of what I talked about with Kane a little bit too, right? You're right. Maybe there's a part where things that are innovative for the 40s just, you know, because that's just a walk and talk down a hallway.
Well, sure, everybody's used to it now. To, we see it all the time.
And not only that, that's a joke because Aaron Sorkin does it.
Right. Exactly. That's about all I had for the technical stuff. Did you have anything else?
Yeah, I thought it was neat that that staircase and parts of the mansion were used in Cat People and its sequel. It was used in the movie Spiral Staircase. I assume it played itself. And a movie called The Falcon is in Danger, which I've never heard of, but now must see. Because that is that's a wicked good title. And apparently the exterior of Mrs. Johnson's house, which is the house of a woman George goes to chew out for, like, smearing his mother, was in It's a Wonderful Life.
Oh.
Yeah, that exterior was the Bailey house. You know, the, like, haunted house.
Oh, the main one.
Yeah, the house in It's a Wonderful Life.
Huh, that's pretty cool. Well, that brings us to the last section, which is what was going on behind the scenes. Darren, I was curious, do you have a good grasp on this to relay, like, what all was going on while Wells was finishing this up?
I know he had to get started on another shoot, and that the studio was not happy with it, and that he'd released a bunch of previews that were not very well received by the audience. I've got some quotes from the audience, but I will find those. Well, why don't you go take a dive here?
All right. So. Well, you're definitely right, what you said. He did have another engagement in South America, in Brazil. What had happened was he was finishing up shooting for Amberson's when he got a call from the government, essentially, because they had this program from Roosevelt called the Good Neighbor Policy. And this program was all about trying to restore relations with Latin America and South America. Because
I don't know if I like where this goes. This sounds like a nicer Monroe Doctrine.
It actually turned out fine. From what I read,
it turned out, like, fine. Didn't we fuck up South America, like, super bad?
Well, no, but that's the thing, is that, so before this period, we had just had Woodrow Wilson, largely, who had sent troops to practically every country south of the U.S. in order to protect U.S. interests and, like, business properties.
Oh, thank God we stopped doing that.
Yeah. They sent troops, they overthrew leaders, the works. And then about the time Roosevelt comes in, he and his cabinet want to go the opposite direction. They're like, this is insane to keep doing this and, like, making all these people hate us in terms of national security. So they decided, like, we're going to try and play nice. We're going to keep out of these other countries' governments, or their affairs anyway. And they started trying to restore relations. Part of that being through, there's, like, a specific department set up for Hollywood to try and get Hollywood to start producing, like, more positive or at least fair representations of Latin America. Because up to that point, they were all just stereotypes. They were portrayed as lazy and primitive and all these terrible things. But, you know, at least from kind of skimming the surface of it, it sounds like for this very brief time period from about 1935 to 1945, it was like the only time that Latin America and the U.S. got along, where, like, we didn't invade anything, nothing terrible happened, some good movies came out of it. We got Carmen Miranda out of it, actually. Became like a spokeswoman for this whole thing.
Well, that's good.
Yeah. And it wasn't until the Cold War, basically, that things started turning around, because suddenly it was like, oh no, the Soviets are trying to take over now. We can't have that. And we went right on back to sending troops and overthrowing governments and all that stuff. Anyway, Orson gets contacted by the Hollywood department for this policy. And they say, hey, we would love for you to go and shoot a movie in order to send to South America as, like, a goodwill sort of thing and show them a little bit about our culture. So he starts making this documentary called It's All True, where it was like three different chapters about different things, one of which was jazz. They were going to have, like, Louis Armstrong in the movie and stuff like this. And then something happened where he ended up changing the concept, and going to South America and making it about them rather than about us. And so, like, the jazz part changed into a thing about samba. So he rushes to finish Amberson's. They get done with the shooting. He manages to get a rough cut out in Florida with the editor before flying straight to South America to start production on this thing. While he's there, Robert Wise, the editor, finishes up what he's got, and they do a test screening. This test screening is, in the words of the RKO president, George Schaefer, like, one of the biggest embarrassments of his life. It goes so poorly. This is the, like, 2-hour long version.
Yeah, I have, and here's where I've got some quotes.
There
there was an audible bad reaction. It was screened for 125 people who, mm-hmm. of course, received comment cards. 72 of them were negative. And here is one of... Yeah, here are the quotes I really like. The cards ask, and this is, of course, this is Orson Welles, the book of interviews with Peter Bogdanovich, mm-hmm. and Orson Welles. Mm-hmm. Cards asked, among other things, did you like this picture? Here's a sampling of the answers, and I will be giving a sampling of the sampling. One person says, yes, the picture is magnificent. The direction, acting, photography, and special effects are the best the cinema has yet offered. It is unfortunate that the American public, as represented at this theater, are unable to appreciate fine art. It might perhaps be criticized for being a bit too long. Another card says, it stinks.
Well, that really runs the gamut, doesn't it?
Another card says, too many shadows in the scenery was too dark.
I actually agree with that one. That was something I noticed.
Another one, no, it's as bad, if not worse, than Citizen Kane. Mr. Welles had better go back to the radio, I hope. A horrible distorted dream, which I love.
Ooh, nice.
Yes, I liked it. But I feel that it was above the audience. It was very depressing and nerve-wracking.
Yeah. Intentionally so.
Yeah, so that was
jeez.
Quite the response.
Uh-huh. Well, so apparently what happened after that was Schaefer, the head of the studio, he gets a hold of Welles in South America in a panic, and he's like, we've got to do something to this movie. So they set up this arrangement where Welles is going to work by telegram with Robert Wise, the editor, in order to try and trim some of the movie. And the studio sends a work print, just like a low quality copy of the movie, down to Welles in South America so that he can at least see what he's working with. And they managed to cut out about 10 minutes of the movie.
Mm-hmm.
It's not clear exactly what was cut. They do another round of previews. These previews don't really go any better than the first one. And finally, Schaefer says, okay, forget it. We're just going to cut Welles out of this because his contract doesn't give him final cut rights anyway. And he goes to Robert Wise and says, look, no matter what, you've got to cut about another 40 minutes out of this movie in order to make this work. So according to Welles, they let just about anybody in at editing this thing. They've got the assistant editor working on it, the main editor, the producers are doing their own edits, all kinds of stuff is going on. And the whole time they're telling Welles in South America, they're like, yes, we'll send you the equipment, we'll let you do your own cut. And of course they never do. Finally, they get this thing cut down to 90 minutes. What is it? 88 minutes. They do another test preview, and finally the preview goes okay. Or at least enough that they're comfortable releasing this to the public. And despite all of this work, it ends up going on the books as a $600,000 loss because of how expensive both the shoot itself was. It, of course, went over budget because it's Orson Welles. And then again, it went even further over budget because of the reshoots and the re-editing. So because of all this, Schaefer resigns from the studio. They get a completely new set of management in. The management fires Wells from the studio while he's in South America. They even go as far as to stop giving him resources for the movie that he's shooting in South America for them. and then they kick Mercury Productions off of the lot. And the final sting, apparently, was that in 1942, they began promoting their new corporate motto, showmanship in place of genius, a new deal at RKO.
There's an honesty to that.
There really is.
I really find refreshing. Showmanship in place of genius.
Yeah, so after that, Wells, his career just really went off the rails for a little bit. He ended up not even doing movies for like 4 or 5 years after this. He just went back to radio.
Yeah, this is kind of what kicked off his like perennially broke kind of wandering mm-hmm. phase, right?
Yeah, it did. And he never, he was always bitter about it. They have these clips on the disc where he's talking about it in the 70s, I think. And he just, you know, he knew just as well as anybody that this was the beginning of the end in a way.
Yeah, we give Wells a lot of crap on this podcast, and he deserves all of it, quite frankly. But while once in a while I do see the sort of the strengths of the studio system compared to what we've got going on today, the downside is stuff like this happens from time to time where real promising artists just their career just ends sort of prematurely.
Yeah. Well, and it's even, yeah, I was thinking a little bit about, this is the classic like sophomore effort problem that happens to musicians a lot, where they have this, you know, they come out with this great debut album, accolades all over the place. Everybody's wondering, like, what are you going to do next to try and top this? And then the next thing they do is so completely different that everybody hates it. And ends up, you know, the whole thing falls apart, and it's a few years before they even bother with a third effort.
Yeah, like this is the album after Illinois, for sure.
Exactly. Or this is Weezer's Pinkerton, in a way. I was excited to make that dumb reference on a podcast about something completely unrelated.
I hope that's in your notes.
They're in my notes in my head. That's basically the story of how in a way, the rise and fall, literally, of the Magnificent Ambersons.
Yeah. I have here an excerpt from a letter Joe Cotton wrote Wells after the first preview, if that's of interest to you.
Yeah, I would love to, yeah.
Yeah, because Cotton also felt mixed about the film and was probably one of the few people who could give Orson Welles real honest feedback.
I bet.
And it says, "You have written doubtless the most faithful adaptation any book has ever had, and when I had finished reading it, I had the same feeling I had when I read the book. When you read it, I had that same reaction, only stronger. The picture on screen seems to mean something else. It was filled with some deep, though vague, psychological significance that I think you never meant it to have. Dramatically, it is like a play full of wonderful, strong second acts all coming down on the same curtain line, all proving the same tragic point. Then suddenly someone appears on the apron and says the play is over without there having been enacted a concluding third act." And that's basically what we've been saying, I think.
There it is. Yeah. I even was thinking about this before we started recording, that just like, it's got these really obvious themes about, like you said, mortality and stasis versus progress, and even just literally about the automobile and how it's going to change things. But then it it doesn't feel like it really adds up to anything important to say about those ideas.
It's hard to see how 40 more minutes adds anything to this. Because I have no idea where the screenplay could have gone from here or in the middle or anything unless, again, they're sitting down to play Monopoly.
Yeah. If I can find a copy, I'll include it in the post here of the original shooting script, or at least a link to, you know, somewhere to track it down for anybody who's interested. I'm personally curious to see.
Well, is this leading into our final question?
This is leading into our final question, which is
it sexy?
I would say in like kind of a weird way.
I would say no. And that question is borrowed from Mixed Review, which is another podcast I'm on occasionally.
Oh, okay. I like that as a final question.
I think they've stopped doing it because they started getting a lot into the more like exploitative horror stuff, and that question gets too uncomfortable.
I bet. Well, in this case, it's a stand-in for does this belong in something like the Criterion Collection? What would you say?
Oh, boy. Okay, so I actually think this belongs in the Criterion Collection because of their ability to pull together special features. Mm. And so if you get this movie, you are also buying hints at what the complete version might be, and I think that is important.
Yeah.
Despite the fact that I went back and forth with you on The Third Man, which is one of my favorite movies of all time.
Right.
And said maybe it doesn't belong in there. It's weird.
But that one had no special features.
I mean, the whole movie is a special feature, John.
You're right. A very special feature.
It's very special to me.
Or what? Our special feature presentation, as the old videotape said.
John, there was an aesthetic that we could have worked into this.
There's still time.
Yeah.
But so you're saying begrudgingly this belongs.
Begrudgingly, this does, I think, fulfill their mission statement of successful, important pictures, and then adding special features to them. So the fact that they can get like the shooting script in there is really important, and I think that should be preserved.
Yeah. Well, and even above and beyond that, the storyboards, the original radio broadcast that Mercury Productions did of this story is in there. They have excerpts from the serialized novel that kicked it all off.
Yeah.
It's some cool stuff.
That's my answer. How about you?
I'm going to also say yes. I think maybe I'm forgetting one, but more so than the previous films, I think this is interesting in that it's a movie that flopped and yet still you could say belongs in the collection because of the impact that it had on such a well-known director's career.
Yeah. And that is importantly a different question from would I recommend this movie to someone?
Right.
And I would say no, unless you're a completionist.
Unless you really want to know about Orson Welles.
Welles.
Or Joe Cotton.
Yeah.
All right. Well, that sums it up for the Madison Ambersons.
Sorry. Sorry, folks. I'm sure you wanted to hear something else, but...
Yeah. But this is what we got for you. I want to thank my perennial guest, Theron Seckington.
Hey.
For your eternal wisdom and insights into the Welles biography.
Yeah, well, as the world's leading Orson Welles and zombie movie scholar, it's important to have my perspective.
Yeah. Did you said you finished that book recently? This is Orson Welles?
Oh, no, I read it.
Or are you still working on it?
I read it a long time ago. I just trotted out.
You've been pulling out snippets for me. Okay. Yeah,
I go through it and I put in some bookmarks. But the specific point of interest of those cards... The comment cards, I did not have it bookmarked, so I needed a second to go locate that.
Well, thank you for doing so. Those are great. And with that, I wish you all a lovely day, and thank you for listening. Bye, everybody.
Bye-bye.